Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final podcast for the Talking Monkeys After Show for the 12 Monkeys series on Sci-Fi. I am your host, Amy Marie. With me is my host, Merrill Barr.
Hey, hey.
And we are here with a lovely, fantastic, wonderful host of the most fantastic cast and crew from 12 Monkeys. We're going to go around the room, introduce who we have here. Starting on Merrill's right, we have...
I'm Aaron Stanford.
And you play?
I play Cole.
Sean Tretta is one of the writers and producers.
Terry Metallis, I play Todd Stashwick.
Terry, fix it. You just
I am the showrunner.
Hey, I'm Emily Hampshire. I play Jennifer.
Drew Nichols, I'm one of the editors.
Chris Monfett, writer producer.
Casey Botta, and I'm the showrunner's assistant.
We are here back at the start. Back at the end, I suppose. Want to dive into this, but first off, before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty, I want to talk to Aaron and Emily first. When you got this script for the first time, I know that you must have had some things that you already knew up front that you had been told previously, but reading the script for the first time, what were your first reactions? What was your gut reaction?
I don't know if I exactly remember like cracking the script and what happened. Cause as you said, you learn various things by degrees and conversations with Terry. I'm trying to remember, did you have like an initial...
which script?
We're talking about the
finale. We're talking about the finale. Okay, sorry. Okay.
We are off to a powerful emotional start. Sorry, what, is this Schitt's Creek? Is this the Schitt's Creek?
No, it's all... Well, I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that Terry knows every... Like, I think anytime we speak about this stuff, to me, it all merges together in this weird way because they all connect and like in a quite a brilliant way, but also as actor playing it, you start to forget what is in what script, for me at least.
We also shot way out of order. So yeah, we would shoot a bunch of scenes from an episode and then put the rest of the script on hold until we went to Prague or wherever else we happen to be going to for that that season.
Because you would have shot all the Splinter Sequence stuff, like the final goodbyes. That would have all been done before.
Yeah. Before we went to Prague. Yeah. Oh. So I think what's here is both Aaron and Emily were crazy busy in that time shooting stuff out of order. So it's probably almost impossible to imagine getting that script and being, because I think the next thing you'd have to do is, I'm shooting a scene from it tomorrow, and I can only read that scene.
Yeah, you know? I do remember reading the goodbyes, and that was, and then when we found out we were shooting that on the last day in Toronto with our crew that we'd been with for 4 years, and that was both like super sad, but also great that we were doing that on the last day. I think like all as actors, we were all grateful that we had that reality of saying goodbye at the same time in our real life.
Yeah, it brings a really nice natural weight to everything. You know, the finality of it in the script is paralleled with the finality of our production and saying goodbye to all these people that you've spent years of your life with. So yeah, it helped to convey that you know, the gravitas of that very, very naturally.
Staying on those goodbyes, since we're gonna be out of order as it is, so if you haven't watched it yet, one, why are you listening? But watch the series finale, because it's a tearjerker. But staying on those goodbyes, your final, what Cole believes is his final goodbye, happens in this way where he has to die alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it like when you read that and then played that?
I mean, I was really excited. I thought it was a beautiful way for it to unfold. Yeah, he loses everybody one by one, in one way or another, and you know, layers of himself are being peeled away until finally, he is the only one left. And at that point, it's almost I think it's almost a relief to say goodbye and close the door on that kind of loss. But yeah, I do remember being. Are there any spoilers in this? Do we?
Not yet.
No, you go for it.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I remember. I in particular the Jones scene where Jones dies and coming fairly quickly on the heels of him realizing that she is his grandmother, and I just remember reading that scene and thinking, you know, how much there was to bite into there, and like,
poetic.
What a juicy scene for an actor, and just how poignant and sad and beautiful it was, and was really excited to shoot it, and had a great experience doing it.
Now, Terry, you want to talk about poignant? You wrote this finale, correct? So this is all you, and of course,
well, not all me. Well, none of these are all anybody. I had a lot of assists throughout the whole thing. So, you know, the madness of 12 Monkeys with that budget is how you've got to get these scripts out. And how quickly and how fast that you don't have a lot of time to produce it. It's not like Westworld where you get limitless resources. So
how much time was there between you finishing it to when you started shooting it?
I think like maybe 30 seconds. 30 seconds. I think, you know, there were pieces of that finale that I'd hand off to Chris or Sean and be like, it's something like this, send it back. And then I remember the very last pass of that thing was at like 4:30 in the morning, and I had to go and the production meeting for it was at 7 a.m. And so I had now, I mean, I was pretty wrecked by the end of it. So it's, you know, 12 Monkeys was it every episode, just in terms of plot and intricacy and emotion. It took a village to make each and every one of those.
How did you go about making sure you made that you paid off everything by the end? That you pay off the who the corpse in the night room is? Which,
yeah.
By the way,
so good.
Damn.
So good. It's one of those moments you sit there and you're like, this, yeah, just right here. Like, the Olivia chorus is coming down.
You know,
it's
you,
that good.
You pay off what turns out Ramsey gets to live one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cole gets to give him an actual goodbye.
And yeah. Deacon has been around knowing everything from the start.
Okay, let's start there.
We do have a question.
Sure.
Go.
Knife.
Yes.
If he paradoxed the knife, how does he have it to give to Jennifer in medieval times?
The younger version always sticks around. Mm-hmm. In the case of Deacon in 407, he has this bloody nose as he sees the West Seven symbol, where he gets the idea that the West Seven should take Titan, mm-hmm, if only he could. And at that moment, he gets a bloody nose. And now you're seeing a Deacon who, from 407 on, at that moment, has lived through the finale.
It's catching up to him.
He's now, but he knows now that now you're watching Deacon play along. So in 408, when he has he sits down with Cole and says things are coming to a head, he knew, He was, because he knew his head was about to get cut off.
So he doesn't know prior to that season two.
We haven't watched it. So presumably now there would be a cycle in which he will have to get going. But we only saw some of Deacon knowing everything. And what you did see in 407 and 408 is a Deacon who had, and he says, he's like, he says to Olivia, I guarantee you I would, you know, I would do this all over again for these people. Meaning he
has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious about those cycles because,
but I just want to, I wanted to go back to the first part of that question is, so when we were picked up for seasons 3 and 4 at the same time, we got this giant room in Sunset Gower filled with dry erase boards. Mm-hmm. And we split it up 20 episodes.
Yeah.
And I, like every season, I come in and I speak for about like 4 hours. I'm like, here's what I think is going. Here's what I think. And we meticulously planned so that in episode, 301, Future Cole's with himself, that's a scene from 20 episodes from now. So you got to know everything he's saying and what he looks like, what he's wearing, the fact that we knew he was wearing Hannah's scarf, the gray scarf. So we knew he was going to be the mother at that point. And same 403 when the, Adler says something about how there's a dormant form of the calovirus in Olivia that was, we were hinting at all these little things. So we had to do it. We had to get ahead from the beginning. That's the answer.
Do you have pictures of that room? I feel like that'd be great. Like, yeah, behind it. Yeah, you guys we do. Want to share that after not, it's not, done. That'd be fun.
But they're all like
it
horrible. Like,
yeah, I mean, it would get full, and then we'd erase it, and then we'd fill it again, erase it, and there's all sorts of sketches and drawings and timelines. And we spent so much time, like, you know, in a typical writer's room, you have time where you spent breaking story. Well, we would have that amount of time breaking story and an equal amount of time vetting our stories because we did what you said. We made a list of all the things we intended to pay off, and we needed to make sure that we didn't cheat, that they had to be paid off in a way that was organic to the timelines that we created.
And it didn't feel rushed either. It felt like when we finally got all the payoff, it is little by little. Which as a fan is nice in a finale not to be like, oh, okay, now I understand everything fits in. It fits, it just flowed very organically. So as far as the pacing went and even the editing, the way that you were able to put that together, it made it flow very well. But there had to have been challenges, points where you're sitting there going, can we tweak this a little bit?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
The last six months of 12 Monkeys was Drew and Steven. I just being in a room with Drew and Steven writing the music and Drew cutting it. You know, Drew is very instrumental in the music as well and finding pieces that could work in just a temp, you know.
It's nice to hear that because you get lost in it so much trying that you worry, are things too obvious? Is it too fast? Are these payoffs amounting to anything or are they too close together? Many months of Terry and I doing it one way, looking at it, vetting it with outside people, even what do you think, adjusting it, tweaking it, and you know, over and over again. And at some point, you're just praying that we've made the right choice because you're so far into it that it's hard to, you know, it's hard to step out and see it objectively.
What did we argue? There was one argument. What's the one argument that we had? There was one. Hardcore
from this,
Drew.
From this season?
Yeah.
The 403 argument? Is that the...
What was it? Which one was it? I forget.
So episode 403 starts with Christopher Lloyd in the house.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
In the house.
And the image of him drinking the thing.
So my thought is I had a version cut where it just starts in the house with Christopher Lloyd. And you're kind of like, what's going on? Like, what's he seeing these different... Because we've never seen the house do that before. Mm-hmm. And Terry had shot the shot of the reflection in the water of the bowl, which was beautiful.
Christopher Lloyd drinking the red tea.
Amazing. It was amazing. And so I cut it, and he's like, where's the shot?
Like, is that 405?
405.
405.
Sorry, 405.
Wasn't there another controversial one in the finale? Didn't you want to cut some of, if not all, of the goodbye?
No. Drew wanted to cut. Drew wanted to cut the 1 minute more sequence of the Jones family.
Oh, right. I did. Okay.
Yeah,
how I did. You? Well,
I was like, "There's no way we're cutting this."
See, that one was tricky too because
the way that they played it wasn't exactly the way that Terry saw it, so he always had a problem with it as well when we first were screening it and working on the producer's cut. So we were, I think we were running long on time at that point, and it was...
Which is always the pressure.
It is always the pressure on this show. And we
started
to
ignore it by the end.
We had done, you know, the scene in 406 at the end was still in my mind. It was that beautiful moment where they all get together in the bar and before Joan sacrificed herself. So it's like, well, we've kind of done something similar. It's not the same thing. We've done something similar. So that was the real... And then Terry's like, well, can you try to cut it differently? And it just... try to get this out of it. And so I basically went back to the drawing board on everything and dug into it, and we kind of crafted into what it actually turned into, which I think is really beautiful and poignant. So, you know, I'm glad I was overridden on that.
From the outside, it does feel distinctive between those two scenes. It's very good. A very different good. Feel. The gravity in the scenes feels very different. Hope versus,
you could do so much. I mean, to actors and writers and if filmmakers listening to this, your editor's your best friend, because they save your ass when you didn't write it right, when you didn't shoot it right, when you didn't do anything right. An editor, a good editor like Drew, can manufacture, take footage from stuff that did not exist. And 409, there was a lot of that, just like we just didn't have enough material and we were able to nail it.
Now, I want to play fan advocate for a second. Okay. And
I don't know what that means, but that's scary.
Let's see. Talk about cycles.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and so...
Hard question.
So,
everybody push up your glasses.
So, the track of the show is the Cole that we're with at all times is always the first Cole, correct?
I wouldn't think of it as first or second.
Okay.
I mean, I know that that...
You understand why I'm asking, though, right?
No, okay. I don't. But there's a lot of things... I see that online a lot. People are like, so did the first Cole, the second Cole? I'm like, I think in the case of the Deacon thing that we just talked about, that's a case of like you were seeing a change happen.
Right. Okay.
But for the most part, the show is an Ouroboros until Cole steps into that machine and gets erased.
Yeah.
It feels like we're following Cole's story as he's realizing it. Like he's our narrator.
Okay.
Is that what you're sort of kind of suggesting?
Well, basically, the idea being him getting into the time machine to erase himself means that you're erasing all the problems that caused time to go insane.
He's like a virus.
Does that mean that there was a point where time wasn't going insane? Because the virus is a product of Cole having time traveled and thus creating the cycle, right?
So you're saying, did time ever exist that a completely sane time before that moment?
Correct.
Probably not. I mean, time did. I mean, it got to a point where 2163 people were dead. I mean, time went on.
Mm-hmm.
Olivia was an anomaly that was like, I'm going to erase time. So that's its own sort of component.
Right.
But
so is it a case where it's one of those cases where, like, because we're three-dimensional beings, it can't see space and time? And it's,
you're not Jennifer. All
right. Do you want to know the real secret?
It's a loop. It's like a train that goes in a circle. Okay. And, like, your perspective on it is where at what point you get on that train. That is your beginning, right? But it still goes around and
that's
around.
That's Aaron Stanford's safety call. Where he's like, I got to go.
Blind date not going well.
Okay, you know, fair enough.
It does make sense if you look at it in that way. It's always existing, and that's the time travel conundrum. I think with any time travel show that you watch, and
that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
there's a certain suspension of disbelief that you have to accept when you're going into any time travel show like this. So I think as a fan, having it done as well as it was makes it easy for both the casual viewer and timey-wimey nerds like us who love digging into that, and I think it's very satisfying.
I don't know.
I think that was also the challenge moving into season 3 and then certainly into season 4, whereas I think you could argue that seasons 1 and 2 are more sort of, like you said earlier, I think, Sean, traditionally vetted in terms of what the time travel rules are. But then as you thematically move into the idea of loops and tangles and this impossible thing, you give yourself a little bit more permission to play around with the causality of it all and to play moments for the narrative or the emotion where the temporal mechanics of it might not make perfect sense, but that's the story you're telling, right, too.
And you've earned it at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, we made the choice that it wasn't just Cole who was going to time travel, that the other characters had injections. So Cole, you were always just through his perspective, right? And his reality was always his reality because he was living it, and it was the only sort of loop. But once those other characters were traveling too and were aware of changes and things like that, we were able as writers and for you guys, the audience, to step out of some of those loops and sort of see them from the outside because they were experiencing it in sort of almost like a third sort of dimension, mm-hmm, right?
Okay. So let's jump into Ramsey and the decision. And so obviously, I guess you knew when you killed him in season 3 that, mm-hmm, this moment happened before his death. And I actually was curious because I went and rewatched his death in season 3. And unlike some other clues that you've done for other stuff, you didn't do any kind of hinting that this happened when he died in season
3. Well, he says see you soon.
Mm-hmm. You do see you soon.
That's the hint.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you heard a splinter sound, you would be like, there's a fucking splinter sound. Like, it's not, that wouldn't be a hint. That right, would have been like, you know. And we thought about it.
We talked about
it. Didn't we talk about putting it in at some point? Because Drew got that episode 304. Yeah, 304. I mean, it just, I know we talked about it. There was no subtle way to do it.
And there was going to be like a branch breaking that you couldn't, mm-hmm, attribute to either character. So be like, what was that? You know, and that would have been like future Cole, a riot, right, you know, but.
Yeah.
Well, you do have
this is hard enough as it was.
You do have that one shot that you then see again in the finale, where Pascal looks up and there's no one there. Yeah. So you do, that shot is repeated.
Yeah.
So you do get that and the see you soon. But at that point in season 3, how much did you know Ramsey? Did you just know Ramsey had gone through something with Cole and then he's back, or do you have a majority of like what he did?
I knew it was always Ramsey's going to be back for the last battle. It was always it felt right. That friendship, you know, going into, you know, your Return of the Jedi battle, whatever moment, you kind of want Butch and Sundance shooting up these guys, you know. It just always felt like that's where we were going.
And Aaron, that must have been fun for you to get back and to kind of finish off their cycle, if you will, the cycle of the brothers.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it definitely needed that's where they needed to end up. There's no doubt about it. And the actual Butch and Sundance scene, I wouldn't say it was as much fun on the day, but after seeing what
you guys
did with it in post, and like the song that was chosen before they drive in.
Did you guys not know
what song it was. Oh, we were funny. Just told they hadn't figured it out yet, so they were just like, all right, so you got to go through.
Well, it was Journey at that point. Yeah. I think I was singing the Journey.
Was it Journey?
Yeah, I was singing and, Don't Stop Believing on Sick.
Yeah, and so they're like, okay, so you're going through the dial, it's bad, it's worse, this is even worse, and then suddenly it's the moment from Tommy Boy, and like there's a song that you should both be embarrassed to like, but it just seems right for the moment.
I mean, that was a great moment. That's the kind of moment where I think that 12 Monkeys stands out among some other more like the quote like serious, I'm putting that in quotes, serious genre fare where it tries to be, you know, we're too cool for school. And it's like, you guys are just like, no, we're good and we're serious. We're as good as you, but we also like to have fun at the same time.
Yeah.
And well, I think that was that.
Maybe it's earned. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that scene is a great indication of like, we're still, there's still room to laugh.
It's also comedy. And I mean, it's like going back to like, look at like dissect, like when Arthur Miller's plays, it's like, you know, like you look at The Crucible and it's like super, super intense. And then there's a comedy moment that relieves you of that. And then it goes back to being intense. So there's a natural manipulation there just from a storyteller point of view. It's like, it's really tense. Let's let off that steam and then go back for more. It's a good ride.
You need contrast.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Things lose meaning without it.
You know?
That part in the beginning of the finale where, you know, Cassie's like, oh, Cole has a plan. Okay.
Right.
Like those little things where you sit there and you're like, this is 12 Monkeys right here. This is the show.
But that's also about those two. Like, you want to not, like, they're facing just these miserable odds, and you don't want them to just fucking mope for the last 2 hours of the thing. Like, you want to see them, like, why do I love them? Because they complement each other. And Aaron and Amanda had a very kind of Cole and Cassie kind of relationship in a lot of ways. Like, a lot of the chemistry that you see on this was just those two.
Like, in real life, it was more of a brother-sister kind of vibe, but the teasing and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the teasing and rolling of eyes and
characters. Yeah,
you know. And it's comedy through character, too. It's not just jokes for the sake of jokes. I mean, all of those moments are earned, and all of those are things that advance and deepen the character and relationships between these people.
And, you know, along those lines, Emily, when Jennifer is... One of the things that stood out to me when Jennifer's getting back to Deacon, and they're actually walking out that time, like at the very, very end, after Cassie has... hug Deacon, which was just fantastic. Mm-hmm. But then as they're walking out, she's like, oh, you're gonna have to kill me. Oh, that's awkward, sorry. Like, that whole moment, it has to be satisfying for you as an actress to get to play that and that joy.
Yeah, I love those moments. I feel like I can't do anything serious without those moments. But wasn't that on the day we were walking out and we just...
I think part of it was in the script. You shoot me and...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm no, sorry. Yeah. You shoot me. Oh, I forgive you. Yeah. Yeah. And also, old Jennifer is the greatest.
Yeah, yeah, Terry actually... Yeah. Probably
my favorite character in the series.
Well, not just your favorite character. You said you would want to marry Jennifer.
I do.
And I said, would you do stuff with her? And you said, yes, I would.
Butt stuff only.
Old Jennifer.
Old Jennifer.
I'm like, of all... well versed in butt stuff by that age.
I took my prosthetic... When I took my prosthetic off, it was that gross material... And they were saving it for you. I don't know if you ever picked it up.
I think maybe you've taken this one step too far.
Amanda always loved to put her finger in it, like here.
Yeah, sure. Your girl. But old Jennifer, I think, was... I love old Jennifer. Like, every time she always makes me laugh. There's a calmness to the character that comes across. Like, there's just, like, it's...
Because you get exhausted by young.
She's just, yes, we do. And it's just, it's kind of the best. I mean, I don't know, was it yours? Wasn't it old Jennifer your favorite character too?
No, I mean, cutting wise, yeah, because you always gave awesome alts to everything. Yeah. It was like a treasure trove.
Because I didn't know what I was doing.
It was great. It actually worked out perfectly.
Did the alts make the Blu-ray?
There's like 46 minutes of deleted scenes in the season 4 Blu-ray. Yeah, coming. It's like could have been a whole other episode of material.
I love the moments of old Jennifer talking to young Jennifer, chicken talking to egg. That to me is hugely entertaining.
Speaking of that moment, did you know your sound drop? Because he didn't know his in the car. Did you know your sound drop when you play the Don't Forget About Me song?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was in the show. I knew that one. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, Egg on Chicken. I actually love that so much that I had to form a company and I called it Hello Egg.
Such a good name for a company.
Yeah, on my credit card it says Hello Egg. I love it so much.
That's funny.
But it kind of, I like hearing you say that there were lots of alts and you liked cutting her, because for me, I played her so infrequently that I remember feeling like when that moment when she was dying, when young Jennifer comes to see her, after that I was like, oh, I finally figured out how to play old Jennifer. Or on the last day, I finally figured out some kind of walk. Or like
that walk she does.
Yeah. I feel like I only discovered stuff about her too late in a way, but... Because I guess I was just always trying to figure her out.
It is from the outside. It's very enjoyable to watch.
Well, great, because I was really itchy and hot.
Yeah, that whole head
you could
mask
not
thing didn't look very comfortable.
Pay me enough to be a Klingon.
Was the Good Morning Vietnam reference in the script?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was so good.
So, you know, let's talk about the final battle. The huge, like, everyone's...
We need everybody battle.
All comes to a head, in sort of real time.
Right.
Well, first of all, I was curious about that. You know, what was it? Did you write it to be real time and it just didn't play at the end?
I mean, we cut it. We put, he was asking about the countdowns being in real time. You know, we had them in real time, but it doesn't play great because
you don't
some
get
things,
to see.
But some things are happening while other things are happening. And then there's something about realistically having 11 minutes still up there that you're like, it just feels like they're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, cutting to Olivia's last thing was probably like 19 minutes. And you're like, eh, they got enough time.
Yeah.
Like, so.
It's not that urgent.
Yeah. So, you know, you have to take more liberties as to, okay, what's really happening? Is this, this could all theoretically be within 15 minutes, and here's how.
So, given that once you made that choice, did you want to make it so that you made sure everyone had an even amount of screen time as to show where what was happening to everyone in those 15 minutes?
It's not quite as mathematical as that. It's just the story.
Yeah, that one's tricky because it's like a massive intercut of the three stories. They're all happening simultaneously. So, you know, when we did plot it out totally, you know, real time, it's like, well, they're shooting up the tower, but they could be shooting up the tower while Cassie's fighting Olivia. It doesn't necessarily that stop in this, you know, it's kind of the filmmaking aspect where you have to, like, split all these things up, even though they're happening at the same time. And then, like Terry was saying, when there's, like, 8 minutes left towards the end, you're like, that's still a lot of time.
You're
like,
okay.
Grab a coffee.
Yeah.
You know,
go to Starbucks. Like, yeah, exactly. Go to the Starbucks in Titan.
Are you ready?
Yeah. Planet Hollywood Titan.
When you were cutting it, did you cut it where you cut each sequence onto itself and then combine them, or you were just cutting them all as one?
So we kind of, in that sequence, we kind of cut them as the big, you know, the whole thing. Here's, you know, Cole and Ramsey and Deacon, they're storming the court, they do the whole thing. It's like, you know, 8 minutes long. Okay, great. And then Cassie fights Olivia, and you just do the whole thing, the whole entire thing. And then you go back, and you know, all those things, you're like, all right, where is it starting to get a little long? Where can we cut into it? Where can we lift something that actually makes it, you know, more exciting? And then you start to, like, block the pieces in, and then, you just keep watching it, and you're just like, well, you know, it's feeling slow here. How can we punch this up? And so it's just constant change.
And I think one of the things that helped as far as a viewer went was that two things. The first was the special effects of actually having like the world being encompassed by the erasure of time. Mm. And actually seeing that kind of, it drove the scene along. That and the music. And I wish Steven was here.
Yeah, I know.
Because really Hans Zimmer points, and I loved it. Like there's a real like Michael Bay, Hans Zimmer vibe going on with the.
I'll take Hans Zimmer. I mean, it's big and epic and orchestral, and yeah, so Zimmer's a good.
And this was the one, the finale, you scored live.
We scored some of the string sections, yeah. And some of the more, but those mostly in some of the big emotional pieces that we did, and that was Drew was there too. It was like nice awesome. To hear your, it's a big difference when you hear your theme played with a 100-piece string section.
Yeah.
And not to say that it ever was too synthy before, but there's just a real organic quality to it that really pays off.
And it drives the whole sequence forward, and it drives to the head of Cassie, of course, truly considering allowing this Red Forest to exist so that she and Cole can live forever. And I have to tell you, that sequence where Cole is talking to Cassie, the speech he gives her, not even a speech, but the honesty that he gives her of this, I will live in this forest with you, but we never have an end. It's so satisfying as a fan to watch. I was crying. No, I was
it was
totally
funny because, what did we have? Maybe 3.5 minutes to shoot that? No, I'm scheduled. And so it was like, you know, these actors can, you know, so many times in like, to do something this ambitious with the budget we had, it's just not possible. They tell you, don't do it. And there's a reason, because it almost killed all of us. But I remember in that specific scene, I was like, all right, we have to figure out, you know, at what level do we need, you know, because it can be there's a very emotional reading of that, or there's an understated reading of that. And Aaron just came in, and by take one, it was like, shit, that's pretty good. I let's just do another one. It wasn't like that was probably one of the least. Whereas you think of a climactic scene like that, it's like we're gonna need a lot of time to really get into the nuances. But Aaron just crushed it.
Well, and the writing was so honest too.
Yeah, I was there on the page, and I think it was just it was a moment. It's one of those moments where it's just all that's important is that it's these two people in a bubble, and they're communicating with one another. And as long as you
speak the words and you're actually speaking to that person and trying to communicate what you think and what you're feeling, it's done. That's it, you know.
And there was a reverence in the words too, listening to it as a fan at the end of this incredible series, with him saying and acknowledging that nothing worthwhile can last forever and that it must have an end and it makes the journey worthwhile. As a fan listening, it felt an awful lot like the showrunner writing that and sharing that as
part I'm not sure. Chris did a pretty heavy pass on that part too. I think the message certainly was in that I knew that I wanted the message. Every one of these time travel stories always has a thing, right? And Back to the Future was, you know, the future is what you make of it, so make it a good one. And, you know, my father passed. I talk about this a lot during when I was making season 3. And no one ever really talks about now, you know, the fact that you can pick up the phone and tell someone you love right now. Like, you, in fact, you could stop this podcast, and you probably should do that. And that's what I felt like the message. In fact, Happily Ever Now, the last phrase of the series, didn't even come to me until deep into post. I was with Drew, and I was like, I just think that that's an important a story about time that needed to be what permeated the finale. And so that was the thing in the room of like, we're heading towards, and the Red Forest was, you know, weirdly the villain's version of that, which was an infinite now, you know? So Cole, and also it was like the payoff of Cole's arc too, from that first speech, you know, about the reset switch and changing time. And it's like, just appreciate now.
There's something very moving, I think, about that, and something you don't see a lot of time travel shows do. They tend to focus on the past and the future, and just a time travel show that's really about the present and being in it, and whether it's, you know, Olivia and the 12 monkeys trying to hold on to it and never let it pass, or whether it's the value that it offers is in its passing. I don't know. The deeper we got, and the more you talked about that as the season was wrapping up, the more I was sort of like, this is a really special sort of theme to build to.
Yeah.
It was really beautiful.
It's beautiful for fans, and we're recording this a few days before the actual, you know, the internet is going to get a chance to see it, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they react to this and how you listeners react to this, because it is such a wonderful message that you just don't get in a lot of shows, and it's very satisfying as a fan to have that ending. It feels very honorable.
When we get to the end of that fight, there's still about 20 minutes left in the episode, and get to spend those 20 minutes giving the...
Which blew my mind. I was sitting there going, we have 20 minutes left! How are they going to kill me now?
Doing the goodbyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, how did you go about playing those goodbyes? Because you knew...
I ignored a lot of people, because so many people and were like, you can't do that. There was a lot of... even I think maybe one of our other editors was like, no, you can't have these. I was like, you can if they each are their own thing, you know? So you have the goodbyes at the time machine, then you have Jones and Cole, which is his own special goodbye and a payoff of 402 when she's like, promise me we'll do this together. Then you have him stepping in the machine, and then you have what the expected ending is, here's what happened to everybody, and then the unexpected coda of Cole being alive. So, that was kind of me saying, it's gotta be, we gotta do it. I believed that we could do it, and that each one would have its own emotion. Saying goodbye to Ramsey would be its own emotion. Saying goodbye to Jennifer would be its own emotion. Saying Cole and Cassie's goodbye would be its own little movie. So.
That was a big challenge in performance too, is finding different levels for all of those things, which were like, each one of them was the most devastating thing that could possibly happen. You had to figure out, like, how to make variations of devastation and, like, different flavors of devastation. And, like, you know, how saying goodbye to Cassie forever and saying goodbye to, you know, to your one true love, how does that differ from having your grandmother die in front of you, you know, you just realize that you had this connection to. So, but I think it was successful. But it was definitely like it was
a job. Yeah. Really, really hard work. And again,
how many takes were there for each goodbye?
Not many, because we didn't have the time. I mean, I think you had to get on a plane. Like we were just like it was. Yeah, we were also shooting at night at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
It was our last day.
It was just not a. Not an ideal way to shoot the most important scenes of the series, but we did it.
And it never was ideal. This whole shoot was like absolute Herculean effort from all of these guys, and obviously particularly Terry taking on like every hat you could possibly imagine, doing every job, doing a part of every job, helping everybody with their job. But for all of us, it was a project where you never had the time. You never had the resource, and you just had to make up for it.
Which is, in a lot of ways, that was like a gift, too. I mean,
But I know what you're saying.
With regard to the writing of the script, I mean, the finale was really forged in this crucible of finality that was all around you at every moment of the day. I could walk out onto set, and you're filming one of your final scenes from 409 or whatever, as we're all crafting and arguing and discussing the events of the finale, and I think that permeates into the script in that sense of.
But I think what it really speaks to is the passion of. It takes a lot of goodwill to make this happen, whether that's the prop department or the writers or the actors to be like, you're not going to have the time you need to get to the place you need to be emotionally. That's really hard. For an actor to just be like, okay, cry. Like, you don't do that, you know? And then as a director, too, there's no like, okay, I want you to think. I'm like, no, you got to cry. We got 10 seconds to do it. It's terrible. It's not. But what it speaks to is everybody had such goodwill and was a fan of what we were doing that everybody did their best. Everybody worked really, really hard. And we were really lucky from the art department to, you know, to just our production, like the ADs trying to figure out how they're going to schedule us. I mean, I think we shot the last shot of the series, which was the crane shot at the house, like at the stuff at the house with Cole and Cassie. Then we had to go to the beach and shoot, which was very, very far, and shoot Cole being alive and then proposing to Cassie.
Getting eaten by those fire ants.
They're fire ants. Yeah, important. Aaron's on the ground being eaten alive by these ants, and I'm like,
I don't think I got bit. Did it was you who got bit, wasn't it? I didn't get bit by fire ants.
Well, I just remember watching them crawl all over into your pants and just feeling so
now
bad because I had been bit.
Take on the Blu-ray.
We all see what we want to see.
I just remember you lying there, though, and everybody being like, oh, maybe we'll do
no
this.
No warning
maybe
was
we'll
issued by anyone, including Emily, so I don't.
Yeah. So
you gonna say something, Sean?
I was just saying we never wrote to our budget. Like we never did that. In season one, I remember you coming back from Toronto and they're like, we can't make the show we want to make. But we ended up
Was that season one?
That was season one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We pushed and pushed and pushed, and then I think by the time we got into season two and everybody sort of saw like we can do these things, we can really stretch our dollars this far and we can shoot a lot of scenes that have very complex stuff and have it look good with this limited amount of money, we had to earn getting everybody on board. But once we did, it was just
sick. And you got to kill yourself. You just got to kill yourself.
Season one always felt like the smallest season in terms of the scale. Like, it always felt like everything was really practical. Let's keep everything to, like, the scene, I think, was in, like, some type of dock scene where there's a lot of shipping containers around. Like, that, a lot of those kinds of scenes is what you got. And then from season two on is where you just, like, we're just going to fuck it.
That was basically it.
Yeah. You know, though, there is a moment, and not entirely connected, but there was a moment in season one where I've always wondered, and I was thrilled to see the payoff where Cassie dies in front of Cole.
Yeah.
And she says James. And I always wondered what gets her to the point where she says James. And then
and she's got the white streak.
And this is that. It's that to me as a fan is so incredibly satisfying.
It's on that actually, because like that kind of, did you ever consider showing us that scene from
Cassie's perspective? I mean, there's some time travel complications with it because technically after the temple shift in 202 that happened in a different time and Cole would have bounced a different time. But it still happened. So, but it just, we did, I think, when we were cutting her walking up the stairs, but it was like it didn't feel right to suddenly cut away from out of the moment because you wanted to be with Cole, you know, and hearing the message. And it felt – that would have felt too TV, I think.
Now that – so, you know, we talked about it a little bit before, but when you wrote Cole's – what we think is going to be Cole's last act –
Where he's being erased
and he's alone and he gets in the time. You know, what was it like writing that moment, shooting that moment? Because it's when it starts to become a point where it's just a picture.
Well, that was
light by the end.
Well, for me, it was. I mean, so many moments in the finale were moments I had in my head for a long, long time, including Cole being the last person, you know, in all of Titan, mind you, and all the facility, like doing that alone. It just felt right. So getting – when you're in the process of you get to that part in the script, you do – you know. And I write with music and try and think of the most cinematic version of it, and then I had to go make it. So it was really emotional. I mean, I got – like there were many times writing the script where I was really choked up saying goodbye to all these people. But, yeah, the Cole thing. And, you know, it's such a great hero payoff. You know, this guy's going to sacrifice himself for the entire world. He's time Jesus, you know? Yeah,
it's where it had to go the whole time.
Yeah. I remember, though.
Leading to that.
That one of the terrifying moments while shooting that sequence is, I don't know if you know if you remember that. Remember we got all the crane shots and then there was a digital error on the crane and it turned out we might have lost all the footage of these beautiful cranes. We didn't. Thank God they were all there.
I do remember.
My heart just stopped. I've seen it.
It was, yeah, because we were like, and we had sent the crane home. It was like a whole thing.
When you were playing that moment.
That's the sound of Emily Hampshire opening a Diet Coke.
When you were playing that, because when we watch it, we actually don't see, you just hear him screaming. And you don't actually see a lot. It's because he's bathed in all the blue light at that point. He's
turning into a spiral.
Being erased.
What were you actually playing on set that day once you actually get in the chair?
When I was actually in the
chair? When you were in the chair and you're being erased.
What was I playing?
Like, as in, like,
I'm not sure you were playing the feeling of turning into a spiral.
You know, as I do. We don't see a lot, so how much of what you were doing was done on set that ended up just being bathed in blue light? Is there any-
all of it. I mean, there's quite a bit. He was in the moment.
It was all my behavior, and the idea, I mean, I think the direction at the time was just that, you know, any splinter times a billion, which is that, like, you know, every single atom of your body is being
it's on fire,
ripped into pieces, and so just, you know, essentially agony is what I was planning.
Okay. So now we get to now we go back to the beginning. Cole is erased, and we see Cassie from the pilot again.
Yeah,
get in her car, and nothing happens, but then she remembers. Now, first of all, does she remember? What does she actually remember? Because she makes clear she doesn't actually remember everything. She has like this feeling.
Is it like a deja vu kind of feeling?
I think it starts as deja vu, and then as time goes on, she starts to remember all of it.
How much time in your head has actually passes between that moment in the car and when he shows back up at the house?
Well, I think by the time she's on the porch and she says "see you soon," she remembers probably almost all of it.
Mm-hmm.
As does, clearly, you see Jennifer is... Yeah. We know Jennifer's on the beach, but Jennifer also...
Birth the unicorn?
Yeah. She looks, but she kind of looks at Cassie through the television. There's a moment of recognition there. We know Jones, as she's writing, smiles, remembering. And so...
do they all remember? So by the end of it...
Yeah,
they all remember?
They're all, yeah.
And are we going to assume that Hannah knows as well?
Yeah.
That's
I would imagine if you went through that cycle and were a traveler that you remembered, there's some part of you that remembers what happened. So there's some Thanksgiving dinner sequence at some point with all these characters in 20, 30, whatever.
Because
Ramsay's still a kid and so is Deacon.
So Jennifer is still primary.
Yes.
Then, once everything is done.
Yes.
Are primaries? Are we meant to assume that primaries are still around?
Yeah, I mean they're a part of time's evolution, so they're still around. You know, and if the world wasn't cruel, there would have been a spin-off series called Primary, which would have been about Jennifer Goins roaming the world like came from Kung Fu. solving the world's problems. Wandering into a village with her temporal precog abilities and saving
this seems like
it from disaster.
All of history is actually because of Jennifer.
Yeah, exactly.
This seems like the biggest, like, the clearest day moment where you sort of say, like, time is aware, time is a conscious thing.
Mm-hmm.
How far did you ever think you were going to go with that? Were you going to manifest time in a person at some point? Which basically...
I think that would have been too Matrix. Yeah.
No.
Reloaded.
That would have been going full Time Bandits.
Yeah. Hello!
The most we ever...
Ian McKellen as time.
I am time.
Well, she meant that I manifest. I see.
Time would be a giant turtle, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What? Now run us through.
It's very Nordic.
Like. Can you run us through the decision to have Jones save Cole at the end?
I got really excited watching that because there's a moment where he walks into the room and he's going to say goodbye to Jones and it says primary code version 1.1. I think,
yes.
and I distinctly remember looking at that, thinking that's interesting. But I was so emotionally invested in the goodbye that you don't try to think that far ahead. But I was like, that's interesting. Version 1.1.
Yep.
And you don't really think about it because you just let the evolution progress. But it makes so much sense that Jones does this and allows Cole to believe that that's the end. And so I think that's kind of an interesting decision that you guys made, that Jones allows Cole to think.
Well, it's an arc. You know, it's her arc for the thing. You know, it starts with Ethan saying, you know, look, you know, 1 from 7 billion is fine, but someday you should think about the one, and kind of plants that seed. And then, you know, she comes and then you starts the episode with this is all my fault because I did this. I created time travel. It's my fault. So coming to it all has to be undone to, you know what, fuck it.
There's
time owes this guy and these people the thing. So I'm going to make this last edit to causality. And so there you have it.
So in regards to playing that out, you know, when Cole wakes up at the beach and Jennifer's like there and it's like, hey, guess what? You're alive. Was there any alternate version of that, or was it always going to be he wakes up at the beach, he's going to go see Cassie?
I always knew that the end of the show would be after Cole, and this is like goes back from season one, you would think Cole was erased, and then in the very last moment of the series, he would find his way back to Cassie. And then as the show went on, the house seemed to be the perfect way to do it. So that was always going to be the ending of the show.
I like that Jennifer was the one who was there. I mean, it makes sense that Jennifer's the one who's there, but as a relationship between Jennifer and Cole, that's such a lovely ending to their cycle and their story. I mean, do you, Emily, Aaron, do you guys envision that they get together on a regular basis to talk about timey-wimey stuff after this?
For sure. Tahitian cocktails and stuff. I'm pretty sure Jennifer stays on the beach.
They probably have a guest room in the house of Cedar and Pine for just
those
Jennifer.
Are the 46 minutes of they deleted scenes. Is the Thanksgiving.
Do you think they have a kid? Now I'm spitballing. They have a kid, Jennifer's godmother.
She'd be Ethan's godmother, I think. Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense, probably.
Oh, Jennifer would be the best godmother ever.
Yeah.
Can you imagine like her just like, let me tell you the stories about your parents here.
Oh, I'd be like, Liv, what snacks do you want, huh?
Yeah.
Cassie's not allowing you to have those snacks, but
right.
I will.
Taking them.
Also, let me tell you the stories of how I once saved your life in another life.
But you should probably ask Sean about what his ending is.
Okay.
Sean, what's your ending?
All right, I'm about to say something very controversial.
That's okay. I said that the dude with the weird eyes was the corpse of the night. You can't get worse than that.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
The ending that Sean chooses.
Exactly. So Jennifer says very clearly the right ending is the ending you choose. And when we constantly debated what the ending was and how all these pieces were going to fit, I mean, for me, my ending is that Cassie didn't turn off the Red Forest. And this ending where they're all together and she's manipulated time for Cole to be there, for them all to remember, to have this world where they all sort of fit,
yet it's healed. That's my ending.
That's not bad.
You know, and we play with things like Shaw says.
Well,
it
does,
you know,
means that she destroyed all of time and mankind for them, for her to have her perfect.
Yeah,
but if everyone's there, we're all having selfish. It.
Yeah. It's a bit selfish, but we did start the show with the idea of like what people will do for the ones they love. Like that was Jones's story, you know, and you know, it was Ramsey's story. And, you know, there's certainly the seeds of it in there. Like Shaw says, you know, it's like he describes this sort of perfect world where you can take any memory and manipulate it how you want, right? And, you know, you have the medieval primary saying, like, the true witness is not you, Olivia, it's somebody else. It's someone who fears loss. And that was always in reference to Cassie, right? Mm-hmm. So it was, for me, always interesting that, you know, Cassie being sort of the everyman, like Cole is a time traveler, right? So in the pilot, Cole appears in her life and sort of changes everything. That this story could be about the everyman who's introduced, or every woman, I should say, who's introduced to this this ultimate villain called the Witness. And then you get to the end, she's made the decision to be the Witness. And that they're existing in the Red Forest, and that's why the Leaf.
Well, you
Red
could argue.
Also. That's what I was going to argue. The Leaf at the end.
So the other, you know, the primary, the Alpha primary, does say to Olivia, "We always knew the true witness would bring about the Red Forest because she fears nothingness and fears loneliness." Meaning that wasn't Olivia; that would have been Cassie. So it was important to me that I design a finale in which. I do think there are some viewers would particularly choose a more sort of bittersweet, tragic ending. I would say the majority, though, of journalists and people who have watched it don't even think about that, which is great because that's not my ending. My ending is they save the world. And I think you can look at that red leaf as it's fall and the red leaf symbolizes now. Mm-hmm. But if you choose... The right ending is up to you. And you could argue very well against both.
Yeah, so you guys didn't put any, I haven't seen it yet. You guys didn't put any little sinister score on the, when you see
not
the
sinister. No.
It's a little winky though.
So like, it's a perfect, like, there's a perfect red leaf right there.
And you hear the theme of the show very quietly in the chimes. But it's not sinister because I just, look, I don't
think about it.
And then you just hear Olivia whisper, "Red Forest."
Right.
Yeah, you know, just to really seal the deal.
I think the debate is going to be over.
Don't go listening for that, listener. That's not real.
I think the debate in the end is going to be over, did Jones have the right to tweak the code one more time and play God one more time? Or should the bittersweet ending have been he gets erased, Cole gets erased, and that's it. And we end the show with Cassie looking up in the heavens and like she sort of remembers, but I really hope I see you again one day.
See, I don't know if that's gonna be that big of a debate because honestly I had one criteria watching this finale that would have determined whether or not I came and recorded this podcast, which was that Cole and Cassie have to end up together, remembering.
Hmm.
Their story. That to me would have been frustrating as a fan. Maybe they get together.
I also think that that's what makes it work is it's kind of a surprise ending. This is not after you've been through this the show, you really are like, it just can't be that way. And I thought you want a twist ending and you want a surprise ending and the twist is
happy ending.
It's a happy ending. And I think that that's satisfying. I prefer happy endings. That doesn't mean there'll always be one. But there's... I think that's a good... Okay. Casey, what do you think? You're over there so quiet. What's your ending?
I do think it's the happy ending. Because, you know, and even Cassie says, like, you are owed, and time did follow through. So I feel like that makes sense.
Time follows through. I like that. And it was funny, because I actually didn't... The red leaf twist thing idea didn't strike me until I was on the way up here, and I remember sitting in the car, you son of a bitch.
You never see her turn it off. You never see her hit the button.
Right.
Which was Drew and I had a lot of debate on it.
Is there an insert of her hitting the button though?
I think we shot. Yeah, we did shoot it. It was like you needed something. Also, when she kind of remembers in the car, she remembers the countdown. She doesn't remember anything else. So you could say we never saw her turn it off. However, my thing is, would Jones Would you have had the goodbyes? Would Ramsay have gone and gotten killed? Would Jones have been? Would Jones have died? Would time have put you through all that in your perfect red forest? I don't think so, but you know, whatever. It's all magic.
You had to believe that you were successful to be happy.
I think again, and that's
the Yano's that's gonna the, look they're giving each
I leave
other
that to the audience.
This was very much the room on certain days. Me going like, she doesn't turn it off. No.
But I think this is the beauty of it, though, is that you know we try to be very ambiguous in the edit about making sure that both stories there's evidence for both, so you can have the debate and you can say it's what it is, which I think is what's cool about the show, is the ending is the ending you choose.
I would say there's more evidence that it's a happy ending.
Mm. I would say
it's really hard to define as happy because the other ending could be happy.
Do you like think they're in the Red Forest? Or do you think they save the world?
Well, I don't know. But I think if you think that being in Forever Now thing is your happy place, then that's happy.
Well, and if Cole argues that he always wants that joy of finding Cassie again, Cassie finding her again, you could say that Cassie manipulated that so that they find each other again and again and again.
I vote Red Forest.
He just changed his vote. Now it's Red Forest.
Hey, he just lost 2,000 followers.
All the casseroles are gone.
Hang on, quickly, let's go around. Red Forest or
I don't want to think about that.
We have to do it now.
I'm a happy ending person. So, I would have been really upset if they didn't get together. But then you could argue that they do get together.
I like this happy. Let me just,
I'm going with happy.
I'm saying happy ending.
Let me just say how I got there, and that I do. What I like is the intentional ambiguity. I do like that they've left evidence for both. The reason that I like even the possibility that it is the Red Forest is that, you know, I think one of the most important messages of the show has to do with mortality, and that our lives are finite, our time on this earth is finite, and things do come to an end, and you have to come to an acceptance of that in order to find the true value of that short amount of time that you have. So I do like that there's this potential that people trying to manipulate that, not seeing the true value of now, of our time, could end in something very, very bad.
And Sean, I remember what you said in our second podcast recording. No. The one we discussed episode 5, you said it was really important for Cole to realize what after is. So then could you argue that the Red Forest is cool, their afterlife? Like, they've all been destroyed. This is the afterlife it's created.
You know, we've done a pretty good job of making the Red Forest seem like an awful, terrible thing that we wanted to fight. That's the premise of the show, right? But, you know, in life, you know, we tend to come to find understanding of things that we didn't have an understanding of before, right? And I think, for me, it's not an unhappy ending. I think it's sort of bittersweet and thematic to the series that they fought this thing extensively only to realize the only way to be together was to accept it.
I still wrote happy ending.
What about you, Drew?
I always was a happy ending because I felt like after the show, it put you through the ringer so much that it just was – it's a beautiful –
you deserve it.
Yeah, it's felt very deserved, a happy ending.
What do you think, Chris?
I've always voted happy ending. I like that there the ambiguity exists, so like the option exists, but I think for me, I prefer to choose that it's
very the top at the end of Inception.
Olivia wants you to believe.
And you don't have an answer, right?
Well, I believe it's a happy ending no matter which one.
I don't think it's a happy ending. So here's my thing. I think it comes down to character, and I believe that if she did not turn off Titan, it's unimaginably selfish. And in my heart, that's not Cassie. So my ending is obviously – I also think – I don't think Cole sees the flash forward of the beach either in a Red Forest ending. He saw something else. I think he caught a vision of his reincarnation, if you will, back
there's
in 407.
There's also an argument that you can kind of make that whatever the rules of the Red Forest are – Cassie would have created a scene that was not from her point of view that we saw.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
how does she know that,
you
know, that Hannah and
so just technically, I think there's an argument to be made there, but also thematically, I think you're 100% right. Just right. Character.
That reminds me, because we're coming up in the end, so quickly before we go into the end here, I just want to ask, that flash forward when he sees himself at the beach, you know, so now we know what that is, but what in that moment in episode, what was it, episode five?
It's the end of
five.
The loop-de-loop.
Right. Four or five.
Yeah. So it's like, when he sees that moment in episode five, what is happening in that moment? Like, is it time giving him a flash that, like, hey, guess what?
I mean, I think in that moment in which he actually died, maybe that he was, I mean, you could argue that time was giving him a glimpse of a chance,
mm-hmm.
you know, that he quantum leaped to that moment, if you will. You know, none of it, you know, it's up to you to interpret that, you know.
So I think, you know, past couple of podcasts, we've gone around and asked for everybody's kind of favorite moment from the episode. I'd like to go around. I want to open it up. If anyone wants a moment that they want to share from when they were filming or from when you were writing it or from when you were watching the show, something that stands out to you that made this experience just that special.
From the whole series, anything.
From anything in the series.
God, that's a
hard question.
Tall order that you would take a day to think about.
Or even just the first thing that pops into your mind. What memory stands out to you?
Where do you want to start?
Let's start. Give me time.
yeah.
All right, we'll start with Casey. Yeah,
I mean, just like in like making it, yeah. Or like
any moment, like, any moment that was just like, this is the moment that defines so this experience.
I know. So many.
I mean, it is a job, but also like you don't get the opportunity to work on a show that you enjoy watching as well all the time, and that's been like a pleasure to do and like be emotionally invested in what you're doing. That's a rare opportunity.
I mean, I wish I could think of a single moment. I really can't. I mean, I think the sum total of it for me is really just developing and then living with and growing with and working with and creating with a family over, you know, 4 years. I mean, these people are my brothers and sisters, you know what I mean? Like, and I think we, you know, knowing other people's experiences, feel like we lucked out in terms of our cast or crew or my fellow writers, you know, just, there was never a weak link. There was only ever love and camaraderie and a real desire to create something good and meaningful that had something to say. And I love these people with all my heart.
So. Yeah, I'll second what Chris said. Sure, it's not often you get to work with such a fine group of people. The whole, you know, every department, it's amazing. But to the show, I think the scene that I was like, this is really special, was from 409, was the whole act with Hannah and her letter to Cole. Because it was like so different from everything else in the show, and it works. And you're like, this show is so special because you can do that and do everything. You play in every sandbox and get to try, you know, work, edit every different genre that you can think of. It was, you know, cutting that act, I was like, this is like the crown on the whole thing, that we can pull this off. We can do this totally different thing. So yeah, this is, it's a really special show. Sad we're done.
Yeah, I think like the show, that like, you know, how things have value because they have an end. I think I looking back on the opportunity we all had, like I remember when you did a screening of the all the episodes together, and we were all like, the whole cast went out after like of the room, and we were so proud to be part of that, this show, like to be in something that you are proud of working on.
Kiddo.
Sorry. No, I just think, and I think we all, as actors and crew, recognize that, like, that we got to time travel, and we got to do different time periods, we got to play different ages, we got to do everything, and it's hard to get that opportunity. Yeah.
And do you remember when you ate the bowl of candy?
Yeah, that's always your memory.
A cereal bowl of candy with a spoon.
It wasn't a cereal bowl. It was a cup of coffee.
No, it was a bowl.
I wanted to disguise it.
I mean, you know, it was a life-changing experience, and to Emily's point, it's like you'll never again get to do so many different things, you know, and to work with such great people and to learn with them and from them. And, you know, it's just invaluable. I will share I do have a very specific day in mind when it will always be the day I think about 12 Monkeys, but we were shooting, I think it was episode 212. So it was like the season 2. And it was when, Cassie is discovering the House of Cedar and Pine in the 50s. And this is a place. And what was great about it too, it looked awesome, but around it had a field of tall grass. And somewhere in season 1, someone said something about the, you know, you're walking through a red forest and the grass is tall. We knew we had to tie in tall grass to this thing. So we had scouted this, we'd shot at this place and we'd scouted it many, many times. Probably was there half a dozen times in prep. And we get there to shoot on the day of the shoot, and it's fucking covered in snow. And you can't see any tall grass. And it was like, what are we going to do? And we're like, we're talking about bringing giant heaters and a flamethrower and like how we're going to get rid of this snow. And it's like, it's the stupidest thing in the world. But our show doesn't work if we don't have that tall grass. And it was always, the show was always about the desperate attempt to hang on to those details. Well, let me tell you the rest of the story. So we were shooting, we were supposed to first shoot the scenes where Cassie's in front of the house and Cole, you know, shows up and all the other stuff. And then we were supposed to shoot a tiny bit for the next episode. We were supposed to be Christmas, right? And so it's like, let's just shoot that because snow works for Christmas, and then just hope and pray that it melts by the time we shoot the SF. And it did. It, like, we got our shot. It looks great. It looks like, you know, Christmas time at, you know, Casa Cole. And then it all melted and we shot and we got it. And that was, you know, that was like our 12 Monkeys miracle, right? Because there was no coming back to that. That was it. And I remember afterwards we were talking. It was like such a fucking relief. Like, people were hugging each other because snow melted, you know. And but it was like that was like the last couple days of shooting season 2, and we had no idea we were going to come back for season 3, 4. No idea. It was
hoped, prayed.
And so at that point, it was like we're in this season 2. We've already sort of tied some things together and thinking ahead. And it's like, what if we got to actually finish this thing? And for a long time, it didn't seem like we were going to be able to, and we got to, and we got to finish. We got to bring everybody's stories in, and it's got to be this thing that we're very proud of. And that's the best, my happiest thing about 12 Monkeys, that we got to finish it.
Mm. Yeah. Probably my absolute favorite moment in terms of scene work was Terry as Heinrich von Muttonchop. Restaurant scene.
Reef Wellington. Wait, you weren't in that scene.
No, but I will never. It's etched in my memory.
I'm so sorry. But that's out of 4 years. What you're walking away with. I apologize.
That was beautiful. No,
the wizarding world.
No, honestly, it's, you know, it is. It's hard to just think of one. There have been so many amazing on screen moments, but. You know, what sticks with me the most is the memories of the people, and thinking back on the timeline of that, the very first time I met Amanda Shule, it was my audition, and how incredibly generous and supportive she was, and how we jibed immediately, and there was a connection. And I met Emily when she auditioned, and I read with her, and she came in like a Tasmanian devil. Force of nature, and Terry immediately was like, yeah, she's the one. And working with Barbara Sukawa for the first time, and you know, what a powerhouse she is, and just getting to know these people over the course of 4 years in this, you know, very, very dark studio full of smoke and atmosphere. And everyone would just huddle together on these chairs and share their time and talk and all of that bled into the characters and the writers, you know, we all got to know each other and they started to write, you know, to who we were and the relationships that were actually happening. And, you know, it's just very, very special.
For me, as a viewer, my favorite moment was actually, it was very back in the beginning. Remember the screening for the pilot? It was during New York Comic Con 2014.
But oh, yeah,
it wasn't actually. It wasn't actually.
You were there.
It was, but it wasn't actually.
Is that a Paley?
Yeah, it was a Paley. It was basically a Paley thing. So they showed us the pilot, and they brought all these cynical fucking critics into this into this theater. And Terry was all proud of it because it was like the only theater that could, the only audience that got to see the pilot in its true audio form, where it was like the 5.1 sound and all the surround. And, you know, I remember one, and I don't remember if that was the first time I watched it or the second time, because I may watch the screener before that point. But watching it in that theater was a lot, was great. And then I remember that a friend of mine who was next to me, who was one of the most cynical people I know, at the end of it, the fact he even said this was a huge compliment. He was like, I kind of want to see where this goes. Because, again, he's like a, like, dye-in-the-wool film critic. You know, 12 Monkeys, the movie, is one of his favorite things ever. Like, yeah. He was one of the hard, like, he, to impress him was going to be impossible. And I was like, he wants to see where this goes. Fuck. Like, this might actually have a shot. And that was really a good moment, just, like, getting to see the pilot and in that environment and see it big, which not a lot of people are going to get the opportunity to do over the course of the show. That was probably definitely my favorite moment as a viewer.
So it's funny. I've been thinking, and I'm starting to get choked up as I'm thinking about it, because I think what hit me most is just twofold. The first is the message in the finale is something I think all of us need to hear, especially me and a lot of fans. I think everyone needs to hear that you got to be willing to live in the moment and love in the moment and to allow yourself to have an ending and to not fear that is an incredible message that you don't get a lot in television. And it spoke so well. The other aspect of that has been over the course of the last year when I've gotten a chance to know all the people in this room and gotten a chance to get closer to a lot of you. And even just knowing you in the course of this podcast, knowing how much love went into the show as a viewer is gratifying and it's very honoring. And feeling the love in the show makes it sing. And it's just so gratifying to watch and everything involved with it. It's just overall, I mean, I can't say enough.
Round of applause for them?
Oh, 100%. You guys.
Did you do your favorite one?
No, Terry needs to share.
I can't. You okay? That was my favorite. It all led to this.
The quality, though. It's got moisturizer.
Cereal bowl candy. That was it.
It's, you know, it's impossible for me to pick just one moment. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you all, and I'm like, you know, there's the group of us that started out in Detroit, in the freezing winter of Detroit. You know, we were always a show, the little show that could, with not enough resources, and it was scrappy, and to starting the writer's room with Chris and Sean, you know, to hours and posts with Drew, you know. At the end of the day, it would always come down to just me and Drew in a room with a lot of snacks and trying to figure it out. And this cast and crew, you know, they become your family. There was no greater pleasure than going to work in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning and walking into that time machine room. And there were all these people that you loved and that machine and that blue light. And it was just, it was magical. And I was very, very lucky for all this. The most creatively satisfying thing to be working with people who were more talented, who were able to teach me things and push me to be better. And, I hope to one day love something else as much as I love this. I don't see how it's possible, but I hope.
And with that, it's time for us to bring this cycle to a close. I'd like to thank our listeners who have joined us for the past 4 weeks. It's been an honor to provide you with these conversations and insights into the final season. I'd like to thank the whole panel that we have here today, as well as those who have joined us the past few weeks who were not able to make it in today, and the entire team from 12 Monkeys who has made it from inception to where it is now. I think I speak for all the fans when I say it's been a privilege and joy and an honor to see that come to fruition and to have that story woven for us and to have an ending. And so with all of us, from all of us here, I'm Amy with my host, Merle Barr. We wish you a good day and a good journey.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.